Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции! Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы! Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества! Ура!
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. I am Siegfried. And the criminal war of aggression waged by the United States and Israel against Iran continues. There's been an operational pause with the so-called two-week ceasefire agreement, but that hasn't stopped apartheid Israel from massacring hundreds of civilians in Lebanon, despite that country being explicitly included in the ceasefire agreement broken in Pakistan last week. I mean, the killing and aggression never stopped. The peace talks between Iran and the United States that took place Saturday in Islamabad ended without an agreement. Effectively, we could call this a tactical pause, wherein the United States has 2 weeks to restock its depleted weapons arsenal in the region and maybe score some political points in the process. I don't think anyone is fooled. The United States has been working for decades to topple Iran as a sovereign state, and it's not about to stop now. Despite getting a bloody nose and having most of its military bases in West Asia blown to smithereens by Iranian missiles and drones, empires never give up easily. especially when taking down Iran is part of the American state's broader agenda of isolating and overthrowing China, which it is. And it's worth contrasting, now that this war has proceeded for over a month, it's worth contrasting what both sides have been targeting since the war began on February 28th. The United States and Israel have systematically targeted civilians from day one, when they slaughtered 168 schoolgirls in the southern Iranian city of Minab. They've targeted schools, they've targeted hospitals, agriculture, public squares crowded with people, water treatment facilities, power plants, just civilian infrastructure that Iranian civilians rely on. While Iran has targeted what might be deemed non-military targets like oil and gas plants, pipelines, port facilities in Israel and elsewhere, Amazon data centers, hotels where American military personnel were staying after their bases got blown up, in like the UAE and Kuwait and places like that. These targets all had military dimensions. Iran and the broader resistance in Iraq, Lebanon, and Yemen overwhelmingly targeted military bases, arms factories, radar domes, and other military infrastructure used by the United States and Israel. You know, they weren't going all out like striking like civilian neighborhoods or like trying to blow up hospitals or any of that kind of stuff. And that's a big difference. Iran is fighting a fundamentally defensive war, targeting the military capacity of its enemy. Meanwhile, the United States and Israel are engaged in terrorism, trying to break the will of the Iranian people to resist, and they've been quite explicit about this goal from the beginning. And of course, they failed in this goal. The Iranian people are unbroken and continue to resist the aggression against their country. Iran has been very effective in this war of resistance, wrecking the American military presence in West Asia while using the Strait of Hormuz, the narrow entrance to the Persian Gulf, to choke off the flow of oil to the United States and its allies. America, the superpower, has real problems now. And of course, Israel has even more. The apartheid state is getting hammered from Lebanon by the resistance in Lebanon, which is fighting back. It's blowing up Israeli tanks on a daily basis, shooting down drones, striking with missiles inside of Israel. And of course, Iran did massive, massive damage to the apartheid state's military infrastructure, to its port facilities, to its government and political infrastructure. And seriously depleted all its missile defense and all its radars and all the other things that it relies on to oppress the people that it oppresses. You know, in Palestine and beyond. So yeah, serious bloody nose for the empire in this war. And frankly, that's the only reason why Donald Trump went for a ceasefire. If he was winning, he would never do that. But he's losing, and he knows he's losing. And as events unfold, I think Ben Norton's excellent analysis of why Iran is winning this war is worth bearing in mind. So I'm going to put on his latest program on Geopolitical Economy Report on right now. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
More than a month has passed since the United States and Israel launched a war against Iran, and we can now conclusively say that Tehran is winning this war. This is now being admitted in major Western newspapers. The Independent published an article titled, "Iran is the clear winner as Trump's desperate bid for peace shows he wants out of the war." This is incredible because most Western media outlets have supported every single major U.S. war for decades, including two wars on Iraq, the war in Afghanistan, on Libya, Syria, Yemen, the list goes on and on. But this is the first war that I've ever seen that many major media outlets are in fact criticizing from the very beginning. Politico, for instance, published an op-ed arguing that the U.S. war on Iran is a far bigger blunder and strategic error than the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. And this article was written by the former U.S. ambassador to NATO, someone who previously supported the war on Iraq. So clearly the writing is on the wall, and it's clear to everyone that Iran is winning this war. Even Foreign Affairs, which is the official publication of the Council on Foreign Relations, which is a very mainstream U.S. foreign policy group, even Foreign Affairs published an article acknowledging that Iran is winning this war. The author of this article is a professor at the prestigious Johns Hopkins University, and she pointed out that if you use traditional metrics of conventional war, it may look like Iran is not doing very well in this conflict, but these are the wrong measures for assessing Iran's position. The question is whether or not Tehran is achieving its strategic objectives, and she argues that Iran is doing so, and therefore Iran is winning this war. Tehran was preparing for nearly four decades, and she wrote that Iran is, quote, now executing a strategy that has managed to neutralize key U.S. and Israeli air defense batteries, severely damage U.S. military bases in the Persian Gulf, inflict substantial economic pain, and driving a wedge between the United States and its Gulf allies, end quote. So today we're going to go into more detail explaining how Iran is winning this war. And to do so, we're going to look at Iran's strategic goals and assess how Tehran has been accomplishing them. The first and most obvious is preventing regime change and preventing state collapse. It's obvious that the US and Israel initially thought they could destroy the Iranian government by carrying out so-called decapitation strikes targeting all of the political and military leaders of the government. But they have failed to do so. In fact, the Iranian government has not only shown that it's resilient, it's probably stronger now because it has more popular legitimacy, because even critics of the Iranian government inside the country have rallied behind the flag and are now supporting the state and trying to prevent the US and Israel that launched this war of aggression from taking control of their country. So then let's look at another Iranian strategic goal, which is to expel the US military from the region. Now, the US has been surrounding Iran militarily for decades. The US built up two dozen bases surrounding Iran in almost all of the neighboring countries. But in response to this US-Israeli war of aggression, Iran retaliated in self-defense and hit most of these US bases. The Turkish state media outlet, the Anadolu Agency, compiled official data on the Iranian strikes on these US military bases, and it reported on the 30th of March, so after a month of this war, that Iran carried out at least 5,471 missile and drone attacks targeting US bases and critical sites in seven Arab countries that are allied with the US. These Iranian attacks have been remarkably successful. In fact, the New York Times reported that the US has basically been pushed out of all of its bases in the region. This was revealed in an incredible article titled, Iran's Attacks Force US Troops to Work Remotely. I'm reading here from the New York Times. And by the way, keep in mind, this is a newspaper that strongly supported the illegal US invasion of Iraq in 2003. Along with the US wars on Afghanistan and Libya and Syria and Yemen. So the New York Times is certainly not in any way an anti-war newspaper, but the New York Times has acknowledged that, quote, Iran has bombed US bases across the Middle East in retaliation for the US-Israeli war, forcing many American troops to relocate to hotels and office spaces throughout the region, end quote. Which, by the way, explains why Iran has hit some hotels in the region. It's not because Iran is targeting civilian areas. It's because there are US military targets that are in these civilian hotels in the region. In fact, the New York Times wrote that, quote, now much of the land-based military is, in essence, fighting the war while working remotely, end quote. So you know how so many people have been working from home since the pandemic? Well, now even the military is working remotely. And this is because Iran has destroyed their bases. By the way, this New York Times article is based on interviews with U.S. military officials. So they're acknowledging it. The Pentagon is now admitting this. And the New York Times noted that U.S. troops have been relocated to makeshift alternative sites. It noted that before the U.S. and Israel started this war, there were around 40,000 U.S. troops in West Asia, the so-called Middle East. But now many of these troops have been relocated and sent as far away as Europe. I'm going to talk more about that in a few minutes here. This is another very important aspect of this war. But there are some U.S. forces who are still based in West Asia. However, they're not in their original bases. The New York Times wrote, and this is the money quote here, quote, many of the 13 military bases in the region used by American troops are all but uninhabitable, end quote. So Iran has succeeded in basically destroying all of the major U.S. bases in the region, including the Al Udeid Air Base, which is the biggest and most important U.S. base in the region. It is the air headquarters, or was the air headquarters, of U.S. Central Command. And Iran has hit the headquarters of the U.S. Fifth Fleet, another major part of the U.S. Navy. So Iran has succeeded largely in expelling the U.S. military occupiers from West Asia. So this raises the question, where have these U.S. troops gone? And this brings us to another remarkable article in the Wall Street Journal titled, Europe is quietly playing a crucial role in the Iran war. This article noted that the U.S. military is using many bases across Europe. It notes that U.S. bombers, drones, and ships have been fueled, armed, and launched via bases in the UK, Germany, Portugal, Italy, France, and Greece. And it notes that the nerve center of the U.S. war against Iran is the Ramstein base in Germany. And together, these military bases in Europe are, quote, facilitating one of the most logistically complex operations the U.S. military has been involved in for decades, end quote. The Wall Street Journal quoted a U.S. Air Force general who is the top military commander of NATO, and he said most European U.S. allies, quote, have been extremely supportive, end quote. The U.S. has around 40 military bases across Europe, which host 80,000 U.S. military forces, and the Wall Street Journal described Europe as a, quote, launch pad for U.S. operations in both the Middle East and Africa, end quote. The report also included a map showing some of the bases that the U.S. is using in Europe in order to wage this war on Iran. Again, these bases are located in the UK, Germany, Portugal, Italy, France, and Greece. Therefore, all of these countries are parties to the war. Some of their governments may claim that supposedly they're neutral or claim they're not involved in the war. That is not true. They are parties to the conflict. They are involved because they're allowing the U.S. to use their territory to wage this war of aggression against Iran. So with all of that said, let's look back at the list of Iran's strategic goals in this war. It can pretty conclusively be said that, at least in the short term, Iran has largely succeeded in expelling the U.S. military from West Asia. Now, it's certainly possible that after this war ends, the U.S. could rebuild some of these military bases and continue deploying U.S. troops to the region. However, this brings us to another major Iranian goal, which is to force the regimes of the Persian Gulf to reconsider their alliance with the U.S. and Israel. Because pretty much all of these countries in the region host U.S. military bases, and previously they may have thought that those U.S. military bases were protecting them, but we now see that those U.S. military bases were actually endangering them, because when there's another war in the future, Iran will likely hit these Persian Gulf regimes because they're facilitating the U.S. war. They're not neutral. Again, these Persian Gulf regimes claim that supposedly they're not parties to the conflict. It's not true. They're allowing the U.S. to use their territory to wage war on Iran, which is why they have been hit in retaliation in self-defense by Tehran. So this is naturally going to make them second guess in the future when the U.S. tries to rebuild these bases. Some of these Gulf regimes may say, well, you know, we don't really want these bases because we thought you were protecting us, but you're actually not protecting us. So no, thank you. Now, this is an argument that many analysts have been making, but to be honest, I'm not very confident this is true. I think, honestly, that if the U.S. wants to rebuild these bases, regimes like Saudi Arabia and Qatar and the UAE, they're probably going to allow the U.S. military to continue occupying their countries. And that's because these regimes are very unpopular, and honestly, they have very little legitimacy. If you look at the regimes of the Persian Gulf, the majority of the population of the region does not have citizenship. They consist of foreign nationals, especially in countries like Qatar and the UAE, where nearly 90% of the people who live in those countries are foreign nationals. Only around 10% of the population actually has citizenship, and these are wealthy elites who benefit from the country's massive oil and natural gas reserves. And these wealthy elites get bribed essentially by these monarchies with very generous welfare states. But if and when that tap is closed, it's turned off, they no longer have significant export revenue from exporting oil and gas, and they can no longer pay for these very generous welfare states, not only will these small handful of elites potentially rebel against the monarchy, but also the vast majority of the population consists of these migrant workers who are often working in horrific conditions, slave-like conditions. They often have their passports taken away from them. They could also rebel at any moment. So in many ways, I think these U.S. military bases are there to basically prop up these unpopular monarchies, these dictatorships, these hereditary dictatorships in Saudi Arabia and the UAE and Qatar. And if the U.S. military does eventually leave the region, it's very possible that these regimes could collapse. Certainly in countries like Bahrain, that has a majority Shia population, and the regime is a Sunni sectarian minority regime that is very unpopular, it is quite possible that some of these regimes could collapse as a product of this war. But that's another issue. The main issue we're focusing on today is assessing why Iran is winning this war. And one of the goals of Tehran has been to pressure the Gulf regimes not to normalize relations with Israel. And in recent years, there's been a lot of discussion and pressure by the U.S. government on the Saudi monarchy to normalize relations with Tel Aviv. This came after the first Trump administration in 2020 successfully pressured the UAE and Bahrain to officially normalize relations with the Israeli regime in the so-called Abraham Accords. And ever since then, the U.S. has been trying to pressure other Gulf regimes to also normalize relations with the Israeli regime. This is not only under Trump, but also under Joe Biden. His administration also tried to pressure Saudi Arabia to recognize Israel, and Riyadh was hesitant, and now in his second term, Trump has been trying to do this once again. But I think this war is now going to incentivize the other Gulf regimes to second guess or triple guess any possibility of normalizing with Israel, because they now see that there are very high consequences for being allied with the U.S. and Israel if and when there's another war with Iran. And this could literally make the region inhospitable. I'm not exaggerating, because as part of this war, the U.S. and Israel have bombed desalination plants in Iran. It's important to keep in mind that much of West Asia consists of deserts, not so much Iran, but certainly a country like Saudi Arabia. And these Persian Gulf monarchies would collapse without desalination plants because it would be impossible to generate enough fresh water. They have to use these desalination plants to remove salt from salt water in order to make it potable, usable for humans. But in retaliation to the U.S.-Israeli attacks on Iranian desalination plants, it's possible that Tehran could hit some of the desalination plants in the Gulf regimes, which would force millions of people to leave these countries. They could potentially collapse. So previously, some of the Gulf regimes like the UAE and Bahrain thought they would get more benefits than costs by normalizing relations with Israel, but the other Gulf regimes will likely reassess that decision now and say, we should not have anything to do with Israel because we don't want to be targets in a potential future war. So in that sense, this is another major victory for Iran. Even if the Gulf regimes do not cut off their alliance completely with the US and Israel, the fact that they're even being forced to reconsider it is a strategic victory for Tehran. So getting back to the list of goals, this brings us to another goal. Iran has wanted sanctions lifted. Let's not forget that in 2015, Iran signed the nuclear deal, officially known as the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Iran signed this with the US and the other permanent members of the UN Security Council and the European Union. It was written into international law, and the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, said very clearly that Iran was abiding by the agreement. It was not violating the nuclear deal. Despite that, in 2018, during Trump's first term, he withdrew unilaterally from the JCPOA in violation of international law. He sabotaged the Iran nuclear deal, and he imposed sanctions on Iran. Again, I must stress, this was a clear violation of international law. And ever since then, Iran has suffered economically due to the US so-called maximum pressure campaign against it. In fact, just a few weeks before the US and Israel launched this war on Iran, Trump's Treasury Secretary, the billionaire hedge fund manager from Wall Street, Scott Bessent, he did an interview on Fox News in which he boasted that the US sanctions against Iran were responsible for collapsing Iran's economy, as he put it. And Washington proudly took credit for the sky-high rates of inflation, the shortage of goods, and the mass protests that were going on in Iran due to the economic suffering caused by these US sanctions. So Iran has really wanted to get these sanctions lifted. They've caused so much pain. And ironically, one of the results of this war is that the US has been forced to lift sanctions on Iran. Now, I don't think this is a long-term decision. I think this is a short-term decision. But regardless, the message in Tehran is very clear. It defended itself in this war. It exacted a cost upon the US and its allies, and it pressured Washington to lift sanctions. Treasury Secretary Bessent, who just a few weeks ago was boasting of how the sanctions collapsed Iran's economy, he was personally forced to make exemptions for these sanctions on Iran to allow Tehran to export its oil. And why is that? It's because Iran demonstrated that it has significant leverage by controlling access to the Strait of Hormuz. This is a narrow strait right off the coast of Iran that is the most important oil transit choke point on Earth. Before this war, about 20% of all of the globally traded oil was passing through this narrow strait on a daily basis. In response to the US-Israeli war, Iran shut it down. And this is one of the major reasons why the price of oil has skyrocketed on the global market. Not just because of the closure of the Strait of Hormuz, but also because some of the oil infrastructure in the region has been damaged by this war. But regardless, this conflict has caused the largest oil supply chain crisis in history, and there is a massive shortage of crude in the global market. This is why the US was forced to lift sanctions on Iran temporarily, because they need more supply. They need Iran to put out more oil in the market in order to stabilize and bring down oil prices. Because when the price of oil skyrockets, it hurts every country on Earth, even the US, Despite the fact that the U.S. is a net exporter of oil, the U.S. does still import a lot of heavy sour crude from countries like Canada and Mexico. And the price of oil is global. It is not set by one country. So everyone is feeling the costs of this, and it's going to lead to higher inflation. So this is another reason why Iran has been winning this war, because Tehran has demonstrated to the U.S., to Israel, and to the world that they should not attack it. Because if a country attacks Iran and starts another war of aggression, Tehran can use its leverage over the Strait of Hormuz to massively destabilize not only the global oil market, but the global economy writ large. Moreover, Iran has now been charging a toll, essentially, for ships that want to pass through the Strait of Hormuz. Tehran has said, okay, we will allow you to pass if you pay us. We need reparations due to these illegal Western sanctions. And Iran is demanding payment not in US dollars, because Tehran doesn't want to have anything to do with the US dollar and the US-dominated financial system. Instead, Tehran is demanding payment in China's currency, the yuan. So this is a direct challenge to the petrodollar system, the fact that for decades, pretty much all global oil was priced and sold in US dollars, which gave the US significant leverage over the global oil market and other commodity markets, because most commodities are priced in dollars. Well, Iran is now challenging that. Iran is demanding payment in China's yuan or renminbi, and Iran is potentially going to get paid this kind of toll from ships in the future, at least ships from unfriendly countries that want to pass through the Strait of Hormuz. So that is another point on this list of Iran's strategic goals. There are two more we'll be discussing here. Another is that Tehran wanted to demonstrate escalation dominance. What does that mean exactly? It means that Iran wanted to signal to the US and Israel that if they try to escalate, then Iran can move further up the escalation ladder and exact an even greater cost upon them. So Iran is trying to discourage the US and Israel from continuing to escalate and from attacking it, because the U.S. and Israel may fear that the consequences would be even worse by escalating. So instead, they want to de-escalate. Therefore, Iran has escalation dominance because it can continue escalating further by using asymmetric measures, by weaponizing the global oil market, by targeting U.S. corporations in the region, which the Iranian military is also doing. And also simply by costing the U.S. and its allies lots and lots of money. They've been blowing billions of dollars, flushing this money down the drain, because Iran is using cheap drones that cost $20,000 to $30,000 on average. These are known as the Shahid drones. And Iran is using these drones in order to destroy billions of dollars of military equipment, including surveillance aircraft and refueling tankers. In Saudi Arabia, for instance, Iran used cheap drones in order to destroy U.S. command aircraft that cost more than $1 billion to replace. So this has become a war of attrition, and Iran has demonstrated that it can continue waging this war as long as it wants at a very low cost, because all it needs to do is make these very cheap drones. And by the way, Iran has decentralized the production of some of this military technology. It's not that advanced. All you need is an underground facility in the middle of nowhere, and Iran has many, and they are churning out these drones. And by the way, they're using many cheap parts from China. China has been assisting Iran militarily in making these drones and making its missiles. So the US has to spend many billions and billions of dollars, while Iran is spending just tens of thousands of dollars. This is why the Pentagon has requested $200 billion more to wage war on Iran, in addition to the many billions it has already spent. So yes, obviously the US has many, many more resources than Iran does, but over time, this is going to be extremely expensive for the US, and it's going to weigh down the US whereas Iran is not spending that much money using asymmetric unconventional tactics. Moreover, there's a major issue for the U.S. military in that there are big bottlenecks in the military-industrial complex supply chain because the U.S. military and its allies are actually running out of the missiles that they need in order to continue waging this war. The Washington Post reported that in the first 4 weeks of the war on Iran, the U.S. used more than 850 Tomahawk missiles in order to target Iran. However, there's a big problem here. This report noted that only a few hundred Tomahawks are manufactured each year. A few hundred are made each year, and the U.S. used 850 in 4 weeks. So very quickly, the U.S. is running out of the missiles and the ammunition and other supplies that it needs to keep waging this war. Even if Trump floods the Pentagon and the military-industrial complex with hundreds of billions or trillions of dollars, it doesn't matter how much money they spend if they cannot actually manufacture more because they're at capacity. The U.S. economy has largely been deindustrialized and financialized in recent decades. So it doesn't matter how much money they have when there are major bottlenecks in the supply chain. So getting back to our list of Iran strategic goals, this brings us to the final point. We can conclusively say that Iran has succeeded in establishing deterrence. What does that mean? Deterrence is the ability to prevent another actor from carrying out an action that you don't like because they know that it will be very costly for them and they will have more disadvantages than advantages if they carry out that action. So in more concrete terms, Iran has established deterrence because it has demonstrated to the U.S. and Israel that if they want to wage another war against Iran, like they did during the so-called 12-day war in June of 2025, they will really, really have to reconsider that because they now know that Iran has escalation dominance and Iran can make it extremely painful for the U.S. and Israel if they try to start another war. Iran can shut down the Strait of Hormuz. Iran can use cheap drones and old missiles to destroy the radar systems and U.S. military bases in the region, to deplete the interceptors of the air defense systems, to cause significant damage to the infrastructure of Israel and the Gulf regimes, to destabilize the global oil market, to potentially cause a global economic crisis. Iran can carry out all of these actions, which constitute a deterrent, because now it is very costly for the U.S. and Israel to attack Iran again, to start another war. So again, this demonstrates why Iran is winning this war, because Iran wants to make sure that this is the last war. They do not want the U.S. and Israel to continue waging war every few years and decapitating all of the leadership of the Iranian government and trying to carry out regime change. No, Tehran is saying no. We have the ability to defend ourselves. We can establish deterrence. We can continue to escalate and cause much more pain than you are willing to tolerate. Iran has demonstrated that its pain tolerance is way, way, way higher than the pain tolerance of the US and of Israel and of the Gulf regimes. So all of this explains why it is so clear to the entire world that Iran is winning this war that even major Western media outlets that traditionally support U.S. wars, even the Western media has been forced to acknowledge this undeniable fact. Iran is the clear winner of this war of aggression that was started by the U.S. and Israel. This is yet another sign of how we are in an increasingly multipolar world. The U.S. empire no longer maintains its unipolar hegemonic control over the entire planet like it had in the 1990s and the early 2000s. This also explains why the U.S. empire has become so extremely aggressive. I mean, it's always been aggressive, but to a whole new level. This is why Trump is putting the pedal to the metal and lashing out and attacking Iran, attacking Venezuela, attacking Cuba, threatening to colonize foreign territory like Greenland and Panama and even Canada. This is why Trump is threatening tariffs on countries all around the world. The U.S. empire is getting very desperate because it recognizes that its global dominance is declining. And the irony is that the more that the U.S. lashes out, the more it actually accelerates its decline. And throughout history, we see this pattern. Empires often become very arrogant, and they become victims of their own hubris. They believe their own propaganda. They think they can just bully everyone around without consequences. They overextend themselves, they become sloppy, and they commit errors. They underestimate their opponents, which is exactly what the U.S. has done in Iran. And I think this war is only going to further accelerate the movement toward a more multipolar global order. Iran has demonstrated that it has the capacity to establish deterrence and defend itself, and it's helping to usher in a new global order that looks very different from the Western-dominated system that we've seen for hundreds of years. On that note, I'm going to conclude. I am Ben Norton. I am the editor-in-chief of Geopolitical Economy Report. I want to thank everyone for joining me today. Please like and subscribe. Please share this. I will see you all next time.
Del amor estamos hablando. Por amor estamos haciendo. Por amor se está hasta matando. Para por amor seguir trabajando. Que nadie interrumpa el rito. Queremos amar en paz. Para decir en un grito: Cuba va, Cuba va, Cuba va. Quiero abrir mi voz al mundo, que llegue al último confín de norte a sur y de este a oeste. Y que cualquier hombre pueda gritar sus propias esperanzas, sus heridas y su lucha cuando diga. Se enreda en la maleza. Puede que
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was Silvio Rodriguez from 1971, Cuba Va, Cuba Go. And it's a song which I think is perfectly encapsulates the defiance of not only Cuba, but of Iran as well. Iran standing up to empire just like Cuba stood up to empire for decades and decades and decades and continues to do so. Good news on the Cuban front, by the way. Russian oil has arrived there. Chinese solar power continues to fuel the independence of Cuba from traditional energy sources and allows them to withstand the blockade, you know, the brutal blockade, which is being used to try to strangle them by the Trump administration. Cuba stands strong. Iran stands strong. And I want to wrap up the show tonight once again with Gabriel Rockhill's excellent tribute to the late Michael Parenti. It just never gets old. And the reasons why we continue to honor Michael Parenti, I mean, his analysis of past wars, I mean, all of it applies to the current war in Iran, like the media manipulation, the propaganda, everything. Right, he busted through all that stuff in the past and armed, right, revolutionaries of the present to see through the lies which we are fed in the media pretty much every day. And of course, we continue to expose those lies and rip them apart. And we continue to do that. I'm back in the USSR. So I hope you'll join me next week. Take care, comrades and friends.
Thank you so much, Carlos, and thank you to all of the other organizers and the other panelists. So history is a major site of class struggle. Now that Parenti has officially entered history, it is imperative that we carry his legacy forward by lifting him up as a figure who towers over the compatible left intelligentsia, promoted by the imperial superstructure, as a few other speakers have already mentioned. If it be Noam Chomsky, Slavoj Žižek, Michael Hart, Antonio Negri, or others of his of their ilk. Michael Parenti was not only one of the greatest thinkers, writers, and educators of his generation, he also maintained the red thread through some of the darkest years of anti-communist revanchism in the belly of the beast. By the red thread, I mean our connection to the wealth of collective, theoretical, and practical knowledge available in the global tradition of dialectical and historical materialism. From a working class background, he quickly matured beyond the progressive liberal framework on offer, which serves to contain the left, through a humble project of self-critique, fueled in part by his direct involvement in the anti-imperialist struggle against the U.S. war on Vietnamese sovereignty. Breaking out of the ideological encasements predominant at the time, including certain tendencies in the new left to supplant class struggle by culture wars, he undertook an expansive project of political education, writing dozens of magisterial works and providing brilliant lectures and interviews. I don't think it is an exaggeration to say that he has been one of the single greatest educational resources of his generation. This is most certainly the case in the belly of the beast, where the intelligentsia's level of political consciousness tends to be significantly limited by imperial indoctrination, but his reach extends around the world. The breadth of Parenti's work needs to be highlighted since he was invested in analysis of the social totality. Some of his best known work, at least within activist circles, focuses on the real material history of actually existing socialism, which forcefully pushes back against so many of the myths and lies, as in his classic Black Shirts and Reds. His critical diagnoses of what he calls democracy for the few in the United States, and all of his insightful critiques of US-led imperialism, provide some of the best accounts of the settler colony that became the world's leading imperialist power. He also examined in detail some of the major imperialist endeavors and their consequences, as in his major work on the NATO intervention in Yugoslavia and his excellent late essay on Ukraine. These works are not often referenced in academic settings, at least in my experience, and they've had a lasting impact on the broader world. His reach extends well beyond the themes that I've just mentioned, however, since he is also one of the most insightful media critics, and he's published some of the most important works on cultural class struggle, media manipulation, and propaganda. He has also engaged deeply with questions of historical methodology and the political stakes of history, as in History is Mystery, And he even wrote a fascinating history of Caesar and ancient Rome, as Ali mentioned earlier. The breadth of Parenti's engagements is seconded by their depth. And he has proven himself to be one of the most reliable scholars due to his diligent analysis of sources and the rigor of his research. At the same time, he is one of the clearest and most straightforward writers whose books are capable of reaching and educating a mass audience. There's much more that could be said about his project as a whole, but in the interest of time, I'd simply like to highlight a few more specific aspects of his contributions. The first is that form matters. Above and beyond all of the content that Parenti produced, he also modeled for us modes of political education that truly bring people in. Part of this was surely due to his humility, integrity, and warmth as a person, which clearly comes through in his lectures and interviews. However, he also obviously cultivated his communicative skills as an art form. His prose is poetic without being pretentious. It is straightforward, but never overly simplistic. It brings the reader in and educates them rather than turning them off through unnecessary performances of intellectual superiority. His oral communication provides us with the complete range of human experience, leaving the listener with much more than just the content of what he's teaching. It models for us and makes us feel righteous anger at injustice, the fierce resolve necessary to stand strong against opposition, but also the humility and open-mindedness of someone invested in lifelong learning and who understands that the primary struggle is to change the world and that we have to do this together. His seriousness, though, is always combined with humor, and he can deftly move his audience from anger to laughter, from rage to mirth. He was, in short, a master communicator and a magisterial, as he says himself, raconteur. One of the many themes that I've been impressed by is his diagnosis of what he calls the gangster state, which provides an essential framework for understanding the imperial bourgeois state and elucidating the current conjuncture. Parenti developed this analysis in relation to the debate surrounding the assassination of John F. Kennedy. He rejected the dominant ideological position among major segments of the intelligentsia, including the once towering compatible left figure of Noam Chomsky, which was that it was conspiratorial to undertake a materialist examination of the evidence suggesting that the state narrative regarding the killing was hiding more than it was revealing. Parenti reminded everyone that the idea that groups of people would conspire to advance their own interests is readily admitted for many sectors of society. To take but one example, it was maintained for decades that there was a Judeo-Bolshevik or communist conspiracy to destroy Western civilization, something that is now coming back into vogue, particularly if you listen to Marco Rubio's recent presentation in Munich. The idea that there would be conspiracies in the sense of a group of people conspiring to advance their interests is thus clearly not the problem. The issue is really whether it is acceptable to engage in a materialist analysis of the ruling class and its state managers when they conspire to advance their interests. This is what is verboten. Parenti reminds us, quote, "Often the term conspiracy is applied dismissively whenever one suggests that people who occupy positions of political and economic power are consciously dedicated to advancing their elite interests. Even when they openly profess their designs, there are those who deny that intent is involved." Fearlessly rejecting these external, ideologically motivated limits placed on a materialist analysis of the social totality, Parenti investigated the evidence surrounding the Kennedy assassination and highlighted facts like the following. 80% of scholarly books at the time on the Kennedy assassination attributed it to a conspiracy involving intelligence agencies. 40 people who had information related to the assassination met violent deaths in the wake of the Kennedy assassination. In Hunt versus Liberty Lobby, a U.S. court of law found that, quote, "President Kennedy had indeed been murdered by a conspiracy involving, in part, CIA operatives E. Howard Hunt and Frank Sturgis and FBI informant Jack Ruby," end quote. We can draw one clear lesson from this. Yes, the ruling class and its managers conspire to advance their interests, and they besmirch intellectuals who reveal this fact as psychologically disturbed and quote-unquote conspiratorial in their thinking in an effort to kill the messenger so the message doesn't get across. In other words, the ruling class and their managers conspire to label as conspiratorial researchers who reveal the material reality of their own conspiratorial activity. Another theme, and I'm arriving at the end of my comments, in Parenti's work that I'd like to emphasize in the current conjuncture is his analysis of media manipulation. He provides one of the most concise and insightful overviews of the propaganda tools used to indoctrinate us. I'd refer everyone, if they haven't read it, to the excellent and very short essay entitled Methods of Media Manipulation that was recollected in Contrary Notions. He highlights there a number of key tactics: suppression by omission, when the media simply leaves out certain fundamental stories; attack and destroy the target as soon as a journalist or an intellectual reveals something important, they try to destroy the messenger, as they did in the case of Gary Webb, who was essential to breaking some of the story of the CIA involvement in trafficking drugs from Latin America through the United States. Labeling, meaning the use of certain terms in order to communicate at an implicit level things that are helpful to the advancement of empire, like the term extraordinary rendition instead of international illegal kidnapping, de torture, and often assassination. Taking it as a given, meaning how the media simply accepts certain narratives or certain orientations without even questioning them, which goes hand in hand with what he calls face value transmission, when the press serves as stenographers of power and simply reference things like American interests, the world community, and other such things. Repetition and normalization is, of course, very key, and we're all familiar with that. But also there's the slighting of content, meaning that there's an attempt to superficially reference elements that are at the limits of the dominant spectrum to create the illusion that there's an inclusive kind of balancing of perspectives, while ultimately always centering the more conservative-leaning, pro-imperialist, pro-capitalist orientations, as well as follow-up avoidance. So anytime anyone is able to puncture the kind of media complex, they're either cut off, slandered, made secondary, or, as we see very clearly in the Epstein revelations, they engage in the project of a limited hangout. They want to make it all about the villainous figure of Epstein and not ask essential questions like, who was Epstein working for and with? What are these people continuing to do? And how did the international pedophilia ring relate to all of the illegal activities they're engaged in with international criminal syndicates, with intelligence networks, with financial interests, and a whole series of other illegal activities on the part of the gangster imperialist states? These are the issues that we need to be pursuing instead of simply taking the limited hangout by the propaganda apparatus and running with it. Much more could be said, but I'd like to conclude by asserting that Parenti has made a fundamental contribution to the international project of liberation. He shall forever rest in power as a source of inspiration, a model of integrity, a magisterial educator, and a humble servant of what we might refer to as the anti-communist cause. Thank you.